understanding that a lot of the sporting magazines and writers are encouraging hunters not to buy and wear the hunting knives that are worn in a sheath on their belt anymore. They're encouraging purchasing a knife that where the blade does fold, because knives will just cut right through the sheaths, and there's been a number of accidents.
I've had that happen.
Is that your understanding of where safety concerns are now, is to not to buy a knife, hunting knife with a sheath?
And you find also these different magazines advertise switchblade and knives very profusely for sale too.
Okay. Any other questions for Tex? If not, thanks. Anyone else? Okay, we're going to jump temporarily to House Bill 2642 to take some testimony of folks who are on a short time schedule this afternoon. I've got John Henry Hinkson signed up. 2642.
Ready?
Ready as we'll ever be.
All right. Every once in a while, the Oregon Supreme Court will tip its hand a bit and give y'all a clue over here. And they did it in this case called State versus Quinn the first time. In that case, the Oregon Supreme Court, speaking through Justice Tanzer, said that the practice of the police in turning the tape recorder off and then having a discussion and then having it turned on again after they got the script right was something that did not, that was, might be very interesting, almost his exact words, but they don't, those kinds of behaviors don't add very much at all in determining whether or not a statement or a confession or an admission is admissible. Later on, in 83, Justice Roberts wrote the opinion called State versus Sparkling. And in footnote number 6 of that case, she said, when the police have available to them tape recording devices, the failure to use those tape recording devices weighs heavily against the state in its attempt to introduce evidence of an admission, a confession, or something of that nature. Now, the court in those two cases, I submit, is suggesting to you all that there's a possible legislative solution to a problem. The problem, as we see it in the day-to-day administration of criminal justice in the courts, is a problem of taking a lot of judicial time and resources, having a lot of witnesses testify concerning the admissibility of statements of a citizen accused of crime. Every once in a while, it ends up in a swearing match. The police officers say one thing happened, and the defendant says another thing happened. This bill is a suggested solution to that problem. What it essentially requires is a record to be made of those statements of an accused, so that there can, for instance, be a tape recording made, so that the individual who has made the statement has everything down in black and white or on tape, so that it cannot be controverted what was in fact said. This bill is patterned after a similar bill from the state of Texas, where I went to law school. Professor Frank Maloney was one of my professors there, teaching criminal law and procedure. I'm on the board of directors of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. I meet with him and a bunch of other folks on that board every 3 months. He is excited about the prospect of Oregon passing this bill. One of the men that is in his law office now is former chief judge of the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, Truman Roberts. He has explained that the bill that they have in Texas, the one that this is patterned after, has helped in the resolution of admissibility of confessions, and it saved in judicial time. I would submit that if passed, this bill will aid in the ascertainment of truth. If we have it down on tape what was said, it's incontrovertible what's on there. It's there. The police officers have plenty of tape recorders. The Oregon State Police, I noticed a number of the state police officers here in the back of the room, The state police even recommend the use of the tape recorder in the DUI investigation on the road. And they have little clips they stick on their belt that they can have that tape recorder going when their hands are free, so they can pull their sidearm if problems arise. There's no public safety problem about this. It's going to save judicial time, resources, and we'll be able to get the truth. Probably that's the most important part about this bill. It submits the truth to the people. And a lot of y'all probably don't understand or have a day-to-day experience in the criminal justice system like I do, but let me tell you something that's a very personal experience. It just ended about 1:30 today. I had a gentleman that was arrested and accused of driving under influence. Now, here's a man that said that what the police said wasn't true. He's just a regular citizen like you and me. But these people came in blue, and they said something the other way. Now, a jury of that person's peers is going to be hard-pressed to vote for that citizen. They won't do it. The jury instruction that we all get, everybody knows, every witness is presumed to speak the truth. There's probably a footnote to that, a silent footnote, except somebody accused of a crime. But so what you've got to do as a criminal lawyer, you've got to get proof to show the police aren't telling at all. And what we did in this case, a police officer said, there's a cyclone fence there where my client drove into the lot of his heavy hauling place. And they also said that he drove 49 and a 35. Well, we showed the photographs that there weren't any cyclone fences within miles of this place, that the speed sign was a 25, and went on down the line, and thank the Lord, at 1:30 the jury agreed with us. But it was a hard-fought fight, and it took a day and a half. If we have a bill like this where we've got the truth about this, so you can hear what was said, you can hear what the police said, you can hear what the citizens said, we're going to save judicial time and resources, and we're going to get closer to achieving that which we always strive for in a criminal case, is the ascertainment of the truth. That concludes my comments.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Henderson? Thank you, Jack. I don't know if we've got a copy of the actual Texas statute. Is it your understanding that the statute is pretty close to what's been proposed here in the bill?
Very, very close. And as a matter of fact, if you would like, I can get letters of explanation from the professor and from the judge. It's going to take a little bit of time because the professor is on vacation, but he'll stop what he's doing to write it. If you'd like it, I'd be happy to get it to you.
Yeah, it would be helpful, I think. And how long has this been in effect in the state of Texas?
Quite some time.
And to your knowledge, their prosecution of offenses hasn't been significantly affected by this.
No, they execute people down there. They get convictions. They stand up in court, too.
Representative Kopetsky?
Mr. Engson, do you know other states that have this provision?
I don't. I would submit to you that the failure of another state to have a good statute has never slowed Oregon down. Look at our clean air, our clean water, our clean freeways without the billboards, the lawyer search bill. We've been a leader. I'm kind of embarrassed that Texas got here ahead of us on this one. But in any event, that's where I went to school, and I do have some allegiance to the Lone Star State.
Sure.
Representative Kopetsky.
What happens if the tape recorder breaks down?
That's no problem. That's something that can be explained. That's the truth. If it happened, it happened. It's no problem. There shouldn't be any problem with that, Mr.
So I'm sorry. So that means the statement would be admissible or
yes.
Not?
Yes. I would suggest to you that things over which the police have no control is going to rule a confession admissible under this bill. I don't see that as a problem at all.
On the other hand, do you think that all of a sudden a lot of tape recorders might be breaking down out there?
Well, we'll come back here in 2 years if that's a problem. But if the case is big enough and it's bad enough, we'll subpoena the tape recorder in. We'll get some hotshot electronics expert to look at it if that's what's really happening. But I don't think that the police are of such ill mind that they're going to be doing that. I mean, if it happens, it happens. It happens every once in a while in our district courts, but I don't think it's going to happen too much.
I glanced through the bill rather quickly. I didn't see an exception in here for broken tape recorder.
I think there's a section there that, that it doesn't say broken tape recorders, but there are there's an excuse clause.
Oh, okay.
Okay, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How long has the federal Miranda law, whatever it is, been in effect?
I think it's 66.
And there have been no real problems, no need for this until recently. I guess I'm looking for what is the impetus. I mean, I heard your testimony, and yet, why now? Why not 5 years ago?
There's a, okay, excellent question. There's a possibility that this may be made by a court rule, by a judicial decision. The Oregon Supreme Court has hinted over and over again that this is a problem. When the police have some sort of equipment available to them, they can make it just simple as the dickens. But because they're involved in the competitive enterprise of ferreting out crime, here's the reality. The way that it happens in the station house, the way that it happens where they get confessions, the police will say some things. And then they'll get the person to talking, and this will all be not recorded. And then pretty soon the person will start to say something that goes along with what they want to hear. And during that period of time, that's the time when there's the possibility that there are inducements made, express or implied, that render the statement involuntary. And usually the circumstances are that it's a citizen accused and the police. So you don't have a citizen eyewitness observer that can corroborate, like I was talking about with the 25 mile an hour sign and no cyclone fences and all that. So the person is in a very difficult posture. The reason for suggesting this bill now is the suggestions that the Oregon Supreme Court has made, and let's face it, we don't have enough judicial time in Oregon. It is really getting to be a crisis. And this will speed things up, and I submit to you, immeasurably. Frequently in cases such as this, where we're attacking the admissibility of the statement, I'm in court for half a day and more. I'm talking about not on a murder case. I mean, they're half a day. If we've got a tape recording of all this, there isn't much more that needs to be said.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions?
Thank you for your
questions. Thanks very much, Jack. Okay, Mr. Lang, Keith Lang here.
Short, quick, and easy. I don't let it sit through 2 afternoons waiting. Anyway, I'm dead. And meeting that bill which I support, as far as I know, the majority of death do support that too. Except for one place on section 5, lines 14 and 15. From reading the bill, it would seem to be mandatory that the deaf person have an interpreter. I think that should be up to the deaf person. If he wants one, fine. And more, not all deaf people in this state know sign language anyway. There are many people who lose their hearing 30, 40, 50. They don't know it. What would you do then? I think there should be a provision to waive that if the deaf person wants. Second point that I think needs to be thought about is, who pays the interpreter? We've had problems with that for years. They say you do, this guy says you do, this guy says that you do. Who pays? Ends up almost the person himself has to pay. I think there should be language saying who will pay.
Okay, Mr. Lang, we have your written comments here. Are there any questions for Mr. Lang?
Yes.
Okay. I understand Mr. Lang can read our lips pretty well, so.
Thank you, Mr. Lang. If you could help me out, you question, or you say that there's been a problem in terms of who pays for interpreters.
Okay, I can't read you. You try.
Okay. a problem in who pays for the interpreter?
If that's true, but they come out.
Who pays for the interpreter now? Usually the person himself has to find the place to pay, or pay for it out of his own pocket, or get a person who's willing to do it for me.
Is that true for the criminal justice system as well?
For persons accused of crimes also? He's nodding yes. Yeah.
Thank you.
That has been a problem for several years now. I know of one case where a deaf person was asked to be a juror, and he had to pay the interpreter fee out of his own pocket. That was $400.
Was that a recent case?
Was that a recent case, Mr. Lang?
A year ago.
Do you know which county?
Multnomah.
We may want to talk to Mr. Linden from the State Court Administrator's Office for some more information about who's responsible.
Somewhere you have to find out who's responsible. Somewhere.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Lang. I know you were here for 2 days and waited quite a while. Appreciate you coming in. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to move on to 2663, which is up again for first hearing today. And we have as the proponents of this bill the American Civil Liberties Union. Ms. Remington, if you'd like to lead us off, and if you'd like to be joined by anyone, please feel free.
At the time, Stevie Remington representing the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. At the time this was scheduled for a first hearing and you didn't reach it, I had mailed to you the statement we had prepared, and I believe it should be in your folder, statement in support of House Bill 2663. This is what we consider a housekeeping bill that we would like to see introduced every session, and if you could ever come to directing legislative council to have it prepared well ahead of time, we would like to see that done. What we're trying to do is to be sure at a minimum that when either the Oregon Appellate Courts or the U.S. District Court or Ninth Circuit, when a statute in Oregon in part or in whole has been finally struck down by the courts as unconstitutional, that it does not remain on the books to mislead police officers, prosecutors, civil attorneys, and the general public at large as to what the law actually is. And we think that the legislature in general, as people who are sworn to uphold the Constitution of the Oregon and the United States, does have the responsibility for conforming the statutes to what the courts have said. In this kind of a bill, we are acting only on what the courts have said and trying not to go beyond what they have said, as we sometimes do in other bills. When I had this bill introduced, or our draft included two more statutes, which you have already had before you in separate bills, the harassment statute and the one dealing with distributing obscene materials to minors. Legislative Council took those out of our omnibus bill because there were other bills in. So as now drafted by Legislative Council, the first statute we are dealing with is one regarding the compelling of witnesses to testify. We have an Oregon constitutional provision, Article 1, Section 12, which says, similar to the Fifth Amendment, that individuals cannot be compelled to testify against themselves. In 1971 or 73, I don't recall which, but in the criminal code revision, against our opposition and a large number of legislators, they did enact what was called a transactional immunity bill that would allow you to compel a person to testify against himself, but granting immunity that they could not be prosecuted at all for any crime to which they testified. We opposed that because we said Oregon cannot provide that full protection. That is, if I confess to a crime, part of which also took place in California, or is against federal law, there is no way that the state of Oregon can prevent the state of California or the federal government from prosecuting on the basis of my testimony. Later on, it was amended to provide for what is called use immunity, and said that they only protected you against the direct use of the testimony, but they could go ahead and prosecute you for the crime to which you testified as long as they found some corroborating evidence. In State v. Soriano, which was just decided in 1984, the Oregon Supreme Court said very clearly, it was affirmed by the Supreme Court, but in an Oregon appellate decision written by Judge Gillette, with a lot of historical research, he said, in Oregon, you simply cannot have use immunity. That is unconstitutional. The language that we have inserted in boldface in Section 1, we did because that was language that is very, very close to the original transactional immunity and substantially the same as that the court indicated would be a transactional immunity clause. It may or may not be unconstitutional in the long run if we ever have a provision where someone confessed to something in California and is being prosecuted in Oregon. We could test that one, but we're suggesting only that you do what the court said you had to do. Obviously, Section 2 deals very narrowly with the problem that Representative Phillips brought up in a broader way. We were simply, in this bill, trying to say, at least we delete switchblade knives as possession of, because the Supreme Court in State v. Delgado said that that cannot be prohibited. Section 3 is the result of a 1984 decision by the United States District Court, which is an unpublished decision. Earlier decisions in that case have been published, and there's a cite in the testimony to a Ninth Circuit, but that was really on the procedural question of whether it should be dismissed as for lack of standing. I did provide counsel with a copy.
Excuse me.
Sure, go ahead.
You use the term unpublished. I mean, what's the difference between published and unpublished?
In this case, the U.S. District Court ruled from the bench orally, did not write an opinion. We have only a transcript of his comments, and it has not been published in a law book, and there's no cite to it. And I did provide counsel with a copy of that. But what the U.S. District Court did was to say that the deleted language in Section 3, no textbook shall be used in the schools which speak slightingly of the founders of the Republic or of those who preserve the Union or which belittles our individual their work, is a violation of the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. Those are the three there. I really don't care what you do about the switchblade knives, except that I think this is the minimum you should do. I don't think it would hurt to leave it in this bill in case Representative Phillips' bill doesn't pass, but then yours should follow this one and revise it. I would also like to suggest that in view of the fact that you could not come to agreement on modifying the bill on distributing obscenity to minors, that should, at least the deletion of the word nudity should be incorporated in this bill. But that would leave, is it 2076? Is that the number?
It's blocked.
I think it's 2080.
Okay, there are two of them. But that would leave this one here as a vehicle in case anyone could come up with language that could follow this and amend it in a constitutional manner. I'm ready to answer any questions I can.
Okay, counsel?
I think I misunderstood you. At the beginning of your presentation, I thought you said that this bill was designed to take care of any sections of the statute that had been found unconstitutional by not leaving them on the books. But then you went on to discuss these three different concepts. I don't see any language in the bill that would do that. Did I misunderstand you?
The three different what?
Well, I thought you said the bill was designed to take care of the problem of striking from the books any language that the courts found unconstitutional, all right? But I don't find any language in the bill that does that. Did I misunderstand you?
No. Excuse me. In counsel, in Section 1, we are deleting the use immunity, which they felt unconstitutional.
Right. But you, this bill is designed to speak to specific situations where the court has ruled, not in a broad sense. All right. Thank
That's
you.
Right.
All right.
The court has already ruled, and this is just to conform the statutes to the court's decisions.
Which brings up a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also understood when Stevie first started talking something about it would be nice if there were a law that would do this.
Oh.
Is that not constitutional? Is that, you know, I saw a little tongue in cheek there, but I'm sitting here wondering legally how that works. Does the legislature have to go through each law one by one as the court would declare them unconstitutional?
Well, maybe Representative Kubeski wants to take a cut at that, or maybe that's a question we should ask our counsel to direct Mr. Clifford for a more precise answer.
Yeah, I don't need an answer today, but I am curious.
I think because the Law Improvement Committee is charged in part with the responsibility of reviewing court decisions, federal and state, and has, during the past interim, brought to us several bills which purport to do what it is Stevie has suggested is appropriate. I guess because we're operating under that procedure, that it is because legislative council feels they cannot themselves, as editors of ORS, make those kinds of substantive changes, notwithstanding the fact that the only purpose is to try to conform with court interpretations. And it does, as Ms. Remington has pointed out, and I think as we've discovered, you do have a problem with the law on the books being different from what, in fact, the courts have said the law is or ought to be.
Mr. Chair.
Stevie, go ahead.
I would like to talk about some of the problems and why we last session thought of doing it as an omnibus bill. Each time there was a decision striking down a statute that we felt should then be repealed, we ran into the same problem, whether, and I specifically remember loitering in a public place or loitering in or near a school. And those were two sections of one statute which were struck down separately. And we would introduce a bill to repeal them. And there were lots of people that were concerned about potential problems. And session after session, it would stay in committee and people would work toward revising it. And then it died in committee. And you still had the unconstitutional statutes, and people were threatened with arrest, if not arrested, many times under those. The abortion statute was struck down in 1973. There were bills in every session, and it was 1983 before those unconstitutional statutes were finally replaced with constitutional ones. And we really think this is a serious problem to have a number of unconstitutional statutes on the books.
Okay, any further questions? If not, thank you, Stevie. Mr. Ramslam, do you want to comment on, I guess, Section 2 of this proposed bill?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ed Ramslam. I'm from Independence, Oregon. And again, you have a multi-page item before you that's color-coded. We're dealing with the blue one this time. Because of what the Supreme Court has said, I go to line 16 on House Bill 2663, Section 2. ORS 166510 should be deleted from Oregon law in its totality. In reference for that, we have the State versus Delgado, that the problem here is that ORS 510 absolutely prescribes the mere possession or carrying of such arms. This, the Constitution does not permit. The law is unconstitutional. Further down the page, the next blue marked item is therefore the term arms, and it goes on to describe arms as anything that's handheld. On page 2 of my notes, the state of Oregon argues that this court to hold that possession of a billy, or all arms, as they are included, in a public place is constitutionally protected and would be unwarranted extension of our holding in Kessler. The Supreme Court says we do not agree. In other words, the Supreme Court says that you may hold these arms in public. And the last item, the last sentence, the legislature is forbidden by the Constitution from outlawing the mere possession of a billy or any other arms.
Okay. We do have your written comments, and those are made
yes,
part of the record.
Yes, we had a new addition on House Bill 2663, a line 4, page 2, section 4, ORS 166470, section